Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another show, another week, another, oh my god, it's still going on, at the Damage Report. Under lockdown, because we've always been under lockdown, and we will always be under lockdown. Hey, Francesca, how's it going on another Monday?
Hello, wow, very ominous way to start the week.
Yeah, well, we're
something
glad to have
you here. Yeah, no, I'm glad to be here. I don't think it's going to be a better week, necessarily. Yeah. But I don't know. Look, I'm watching the Queen, and look, if you can't beat the colonizers, join them. You know what I mean?
Exactly. But I did want to mark one interesting point in time. I remember when we acknowledged that we had hit 100 days of lockdown, and then soared past it as my brain began to unravel. So that was obviously a long span of time. Do you know what other 100 we just passed?
The 100 days to the election?
We did. It is now less. It's like 98 days until the election, which will either get rid of this horror and put in a new one that's going to be frustrating in all of its own ways.
Yes.
Or, dear God, are we going to be screwed?
Oh, yeah.
What is going to happen if Trump wins re-election?
You know, there'll be lots of contingency plans. There'll be some Cal exit discussions. There'll be all happening strangely also actually from Russia. The guy who runs Cal exit is living in Moscow, but that's not to say that, the idea of being an independent state might not be an option. Who knows? I know we're going to talk about the founding of America. I think it's important to revisit the Civil War.
That's true.
But yeah, it's 100 days. I'm really feeling it. And I think, like, as I said on the Bituation Room podcast recently, progressives, we might actually have to lift a finger on this one. I know we all vote for someone we're not excited about every general election because that's the way our BS two-party system works, but we might have to actually, dare I say, get out the vote.
Yeah.
Or you know who.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. Oh god. Yeah, I was excited the first time for Obama. That's the only time, I think. Kerry, I was excited because, you know, I was all about the war and I was like, "Hey, maybe we'll get out." But like in hindsight, Kerry wouldn't have gotten us out, not really.
I want to say I was excited about neither Obama or Kerry. Yeah. Very much not Kerry. I hated Kerry. Oh my God, that was a horrible election.
Yeah.
Obama, obviously, more excited to vote for. Not necessarily like tons of faith, but hey.
Yeah. I really hated Bush. I'll say
that. Oh, hated Bush so much.
I really did. That was like my coming into politics was like in high school, I didn't care about politics. I go to college and 2 weeks into college is 9/11. And then all of a sudden politics is this really important thing. So I was very much looking forward to getting rid of him. And then
we are the
happen.
Same age, John.
Are we the exact same age? Really?
Pretty much.
I just assume you're significantly younger than me. I assume everyone is significantly.
It's because I'm wearing overalls I am in my house on a Monday morning.
That's true.
I don't really have a job.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, well, we're going to do a job here because eventually, against all odds, we're going to start talking about politics. I apologize. And through the course of this hour, we're going to be talking about Tom Cotton and slavery, the coming eviction crisis, enhanced unemployment insurance. What is a swastika, Karen? And also, Melania decides enough is enough, and she's going to do something about it. What? We probably can tell from the name of the show. So with that, why don't we just jump into it? Over the weekend, Senator Tom Cotton, a Republican, generated some controversy when it appeared that he was endorsing the idea that slavery was a necessary evil. Now, he rebuts this, as you'll see, but you can understand why there's a little bit of uncertainty, because when you look at what he actually said during an interview, his exact quote was, "As the Founding Fathers said, it was the necessary evil upon which the Union was built, but the Union was built in a way, as Lincoln said, to put slavery on the course to its ultimate extinction." Which would seem, as quotes go, to really put this thing to rest. He definitely said, "As the Founding Fathers said, it was the necessary evil." That implies agreement, I feel like.
For sure.
Am I being... Look, I know that I dwell in a bubble, and maybe we dwell in similar bubbles. Are we being unreasonable in reading, as the Founding Fathers said, it was the necessary evil, as being not in disagreement with the Founding Fathers?
Yeah, no, that's very much in agreement. Like, they were right, and then 100 years later, Lincoln was also right, who probably doubled down on that. And then now 150 years later, in the year 2020, that's still my position. Like, I don't evolve past that. And yeah, no, that's where we should go. In fact, that's when America was great again. Did I say that? Did I need to say that out loud? No?
Yeah. Okay, so look, I think it's pretty cut and dried, but he is facing questions about this. So we're going to turn now to Fox and Friends, most important show in America, where Tom Cotton appeared earlier today.
And here's part of your interview with the Arkansas Democratic Gazette. Quote, "We have to study the history of slavery and its role and impact on the development of our country, because otherwise we can't understand our country. As the founding fathers said, it was the necessary evil upon which the Union was built, but the Union was built in a way, as Lincoln said, to put slavery on the course to ultimate extinction." Some say that was insensitive.
Well, that is fake news, Brian. That's not what I said. What I said is that many founders believed that only with the Union and the Constitution could we put slavery on the path to its ultimate extinction. That's exactly what Lincoln said. Of course, slavery is an evil institution in all its forms, at all times, in America's past or around the world today. But the fundamental moral principle of America is right there in the Declaration. All men are created equal. And the history of America is the long and sometimes difficult struggle to live up to that principle.
So there's some stuff at the end there that I definitely want to get to, but Brian Kilmeade read the exact quote, and Tom Cotton called it fake news and said, "That's not what I said," when that is quite literally the exact thing that you said. It was Brian Kilmeade's voice, I guess, technically, but it was your words.
I mean, this is the whole thing. Like, you're not answering the question. Yeah, you just got your quote read back to you, and the question is, do you think it was insensitive? He can say, no, not really. But that'd be a perfectly acceptable answer. But instead he said, it's fake news. I didn't just say what you quoted me as saying. Mm-hmm. So already we're not off to a good start. You know, future presidential candidate Tom Cotton, because you know that's where he's headed.
Yep.
Let's just remember, though, that this entire discussion around slavery has all been sort of initiated by the right wing triggering from the podcast 1619 of the New York Times.
Yes.
Because they feel, and Tom Cotton has now introduced an act or something?
Piece of legislation, yeah.
Piece of legislation, because they feel that 1619, which I believe was it that it received some government money, whatever it is, it's a bad project. Let's not talk about it. La, 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 la. It was a necessary evil. That's what they said back then. That's what I'm sticking with right now. Like, how can you be triggered by this? What are you talking about? You claim to say, you claim that American history is so important, and yet now you have happens to be a black-led podcast by the New York Times. You can't handle that kind of history?
Yeah.
Like, you just want your history, like, between two pieces of white bread, lots of mayo, founding father, eat this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a couple issues in addition that I have. I mean, he could have just said, I was speaking off the cuff, and if I offend anyone, I apologize. What I meant was they believe that. Obviously, I don't believe that. Instead, he says, it was fake news, I didn't say that. That is how devoid of substance the entirety of American politics and political rhetoric is in 2020, that you can't just say, sorry, I misspoke. It was an interview. I was speaking. I shouldn't have said that. Obviously, I don't believe that. That's crazy. But because he did say it, and in that little response, he doesn't actually say they were wrong. It leads to people asking him follow-up questions on Twitter, like, were the founders right or wrong, Tom Cotton, when they called slavery a necessary evil upon which the Union was built? Because either you agree with their assessment of slavery as necessary, or you admit they were lying and it was just an evil and dishonorable choice. But he doesn't want to answer that question. Because while he wants to pretend that he doesn't believe that it was necessary, he clearly thinks it was necessary and in the best interest of America to continue it. He doesn't say that they're wrong. And it's interesting that, really fast, it's interesting that, like, he gets called out on this quote, and he says, well, Look, you got to understand the context of what they were saying. It was back then and it was complex. You have to understand the context. Even if it's difficult, we need to delve into the context while denouncing a project whose goal is to delve into the actual context, even though it's difficult, so that we understand what was actually going on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, this is... It's ridiculous that you can be triggered this much by a podcast. And he definitely said, I believe that the founding fathers who said it was a necessary evil were right. I mean, that's what his statement says. It's that, like, let's look back. It was a necessary evil, which in what world, right? And I don't even think that Lincoln's quote of the Union or this country was always meant to phase out slavery, I'm not even sure if you can say that was accurate, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, then we had a civil war because a lot of people didn't think that was the premise of the country. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really the necessary evil. It was the evil that everyone was turning a blind eye to. And the necessary part of it, I mean, I know we don't want to get back into the words, but to think that now, as I think not just Tom Cotton, but probably a lot of white people, a lot of maybe it's people in the South, people missing the Confederacy, the idea that it was necessary, I think is a really horribly, horribly crass and untrue version of this country's history, right? It was like, you suffered, we had to enslave you, and we got rich in the meantime. Oh, and no, by the way, no reparations. That's bad. So it's like, if you think it's necessary, maybe that would impact the way you think about structural racism or reparations or the legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, et cetera, today. But it doesn't. It's not that. It's like, no, this was a sacrifice. It was necessary, and, you know, shut up.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, you're totally right. Yeah, if you feel like, 1619 Project, you know, despite the fact that they're professional historians and I'm not, I'm just, a jackass senator, they don't get it. I get it. Okay, well then do something about it. But you don't actually want to describe it better. You want to move on from it. And why wouldn't you? People like you already got the money. So, a couple other things that he mentioned there. One was, it was the founding of America. It was necessary to finally get rid of it. And that is what was so amazing about the founding fathers, is that they were planning ahead to get rid of it. And that's why so many of them kept their slaves, even after all those quotes I'm reading for you. And by the way, in terms of it was the only way we were going to get rid of it was to make a break from Britain and create this great new country. I am not a British historian, so understand that. But broad strokes, Britain abolished the slave trade in 1807 with the Slave Trade Act. And then with the British Slavery Abolition Act of 1833, they ended slavery in most of their colonies. Right. That was more than three decades before a war finally got us to end slavery here. So it seems like we would have gotten rid of it faster if we'd remained a colony. Obviously, I don't want to remain a colony, but it's just weird revisionism that it was their plan all along. It's very QAnon that they're going to do it. It's going to take seven decades, maybe eight, and then we're finally going to get rid of it.
No, that's a really good point, the QAnon part. I mean, I think anyone – look, I also think it's dangerous to look back on history and – graph 2020 values onto all of it. I think that's a mistake, totally. I think that the same way that I remember Condoleezza Rice, which was pretty important for her as an African American leader to say, oh, I think slavery would have ended on its own. She agreed with that. I think it was that or I also think black people would have gotten the right to vote on out of the goodness of white people's heart. Lies. It's also important for us to, you know, to not just go back and be like, you know, again, graft all of our values and morals and human rights, which we know are right now, but which were also right then in the time. I don't know if you understand what I'm saying, but I guess I think that it's easy to assume that history is going to play out for in the interest of good, that everything is just going to happen. It's all going to be good. And we're all going to move towards more and more perfection and evolution. Well, look at who's effing president right now. Look at what's happening in Portland. That's not the way history works. History is about struggle. History is about, unfortunately, war. It is about, it is about actually working and making these demands on the powerful. So anyone who warns you or tells you that it was all going to happen, like, yeah, don't listen to them. Or that, and then by the same token, like, that colonialism or that slavery, it was all necessary for the project, the American project, also call BS on that.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's nice to feel like, okay, this stuff is rough, but it always moves towards justice. That is nice.
Yeah.
But it doesn't just happen. We have to help it. Yes. And on that note, one final point. So he says at the end of his little thing that, you know, slavery was this great evil. I acknowledge that. And we've struggled ever since then against slavery and racism, these original sins that I totally still believe are necessary evils, but I'll pretend that it's just them. We've been struggling ever since. So here's the thing. People have been struggling ever since, but we've been struggling as if the whole country together has been struggling to get over that. That's not how that worked at all. The slaves, their descendants, have been struggling the entire time, and thankfully they've had some allies in increasing number as the decades went on, but it sure took a long time, for a very, very, very long time. I would say up until and including today, there have been any number of people who have not been involved in that struggle, not on the same side anyway. They've been fighting against it. And I would say that the sort of people who want to pretend that slavery wasn't what it was, that it was benevolent or not so bad, or maybe it was necessary, hey, look, we got a lot of money, those people have been around since slavery. They were making that case then.
Yep.
Thankfully, that's rarer now. But there are still people like Tom Cotton attacking the 1619 Project who are not allies in this fight, that are trying to either rewrite history or just move past it and ignore it and pretend that it didn't matter, that it has no effects on us today. Tom Cotton is not an ally in that fight.
You're absolutely right. I just want to tag that and say this is exactly what it's about. I mean, if we think that having a white nationalist in the presidency, having a resurgence of neo-Nazis, having killers drive their cars into Black Lives Matter protests, get out and start shooting like what happened this weekend in Austin.
Yeah.
If we think that the legacy of slavery and the Civil War and the civil rights movement is over, if we think, then we're idiots. We're complete idiots. And we're never actually going to move ahead, even if you are, you know, racist. That you're an idiot as well. But I'm saying, like, you have no understanding of what it means to actually look at our history. You don't want to move past it. You don't know. In fact, you embrace the whatever it is that's happening, the, like, coming race war, right? You embrace this kind of violence. You want it to go on, and you yourself are fomenting yet another civil war. Not the Black Lives Matter protesters. The Black Lives Matter protesters, the people who are actually talking about this history, want healing. They want justice. They want to right those wrongs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's, once again, a podcast, y'all. It's a podcast.
Yeah. And by the way, in terms of being an ally, like, there are these protests going on right now where Black Lives Matter is saying, hey, stop choking us out on the streets of American cities every single day. And Tom Cotton, like, never forget, his initial response to that was, we should send in the military and give them no quarter. We should kill them and not take prisoners. That actually seems a bit more like something he would have had back in the 1860s. So I guess he is historically minded. But again, not on, like, the right side of that conflict.
On the side of the British.
Exactly. Send in the troops and kill the black protesters is not what you say and then expect goodwill when you start throwing around the terms like necessary evil.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
So we're in the middle of a public health crisis and an economic crisis and a civil rights crisis. And while all of this has been going on, people who have been in the know that there are other crises creeping up behind it. And they have been warning, saying we have to do something about this. I'm talking here about the eviction and foreclosure crises that are coming up fast. Now, thankfully, there was some effort by the federal government to forestall this, if not delay it forever, with the CARES Act, which was signed into law in March, established a temporary moratorium on evictions for all rental units that were backed by some form of federally financing. So, look, that is a good amount of housing, but it's not all housing. And unfortunately, even for that, there was an end date. And starting July 25th, 2 days ago, as of our filming, a key component of the federal eviction moratorium is set to expire, allowing landlords that operate federally backed rental properties to give their tenants 30 days notice to vacate. So we had a limited number of protections for a limited number of pieces of property, and those are effectively gone. And we have now started a new clock. The new clock is people being kicked out of these properties. How many? Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions if the economic problems continue. That has not gone away. We've known that it's coming, and now we have to see what, if anything, the government is going to do about it. Francesca, thoughts?
I mean, this is what we've been talking about as progressives for so many years, that trickle-down economics is BS, and that if you actually want a healthy economy, people need to stay in their homes. They need to keep their jobs. And now that we're in a pandemic, that's even more crucial, right? I mean, the cruelty of kicking someone out of their homes, of the police, because it is the police that does evictions, coming to your door and putting you onto the street when we should actually be sheltering in place, because remember, there's no national plan to get the pandemic under control in the United States. I mean, like, how much more obvious can it be that capitalism and putting the economy over human life totally fails? And again, I say the economy is in the smallest idea of the economy. And what I really mean, and what we should be thinking about when we talk about the economy, is the right to housing, is the right to a decent wage and to a good paying job, is the right to health care, and all of the things that now that we're in this crisis mode, somehow we're the ones who have to feel the pinch even more. We're the ones who have to be who have to be on the streets for this. I mean, it's unfathomable. I mean, it's bad. And you know that governors like Cuomo and like Newsom, as much as they are not Donald Trump, they are in very wealthy states. And there is a housing crisis in both New York City and all of California. They're under a lot of pressure. They are under a lot of pressure to get the market moving again. And what that means is kicking people out of their homes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, as we've been saying for what feels like, and I think is actually months now, it also won't work. It is horrible and cruel and immoral and utterly not going to work to restart the economy. You can't just restart the economy by restarting the economy when the economy is chock full of virus. That's just not how it works. And as you pointed out, there is no national strategy. There is still, it's crazy. Isn't it crazy? Isn't it crazy? There is still no national strategy. Just, you know, hope you're in a good state and hope people don't like to travel to it. That's about it. That's what we got. And and we also have a bunch of people that are going to be kicked out of their housing, because although we are just in the beginning days of that 30-day period, some places are already sending out letters like this from Axiom Realty Partners, LLC, saying COVID-19 is not an excuse to not pay rent. Please be aware that when the eviction moratorium is lifted, we will not only file an eviction, but we will seek a judgment against you for the full amount of all unpaid rents in a court of law. That was ready to go immediately when this thing happened over the weekend. Now, obviously something needs to be done, but this is the U.S. government, so there's no guarantee it will be. There are people who are trying to do something. So presently, we have Democrats, including Senator Elizabeth Warren and Representative Jesus Garcia, have pushed legislation to extend the eviction moratorium for another year and to expand it to cover all properties, not just those backed by the federal government. You also have separately Senator Kamala Harris of California unveiling legislation last week nicknamed the Relief Act that would ban evictions and foreclosures for a year. The bill includes additional provisions that prevent utilities companies from ending service, landlords from raising the rent on tenants, and negative credit reports amidst the economic crisis caused by the pandemic. That acknowledgement of credit is very important. AOC a couple of months ago was talking about that, about how people could be economically destroyed for the rest of their lives based on what happens in this period. Now, obviously, I see people in the comments asking, well, what about the landlords? There's considerations for that as well. The idea is that the government is going to have to fill the gap if they want to actually get past this. If they don't, then they just pretend that it's not a real crisis. We can see countless people, possibly millions, thrown out on the streets. That'll be good for the economy, I'm sure. And that'll be America.
The thing is, though, I mean, this is the thing we have to remember. I mean, yes to small landlords. Obviously, they have to pay mortgage. I do think there have been suggestions and there are already proposals around tiers of who these provisions would apply to and how to get mortgage relief to landlords. And just, of course, as you imagine, that the PPE and other loans have been first going to those who don't need it. The same has been happening in the real estate market. And I say the real estate market, and that's sort of why the real estate market is not housing, right? And speculative real estate capitalism that is exploitative, that is cruel, that kicks people out of their homes and then jacks up the price, that gentrifies, that is not housing. That is a market that is, hey, has put us into a bubble, into a crash before. Remember that, 2008? And a lot of people believe that it could be the impetus for another economic crisis. So what I'm saying is, we need to remember that when we talk about the real estate market and all the sharks who make a ton of money off of it, and when we talk about housing, we're talking about two different things. And we really need to distinguish that. And now is the time to say speculative capitalism, when it comes to housing, is wrong. It's morally wrong.
Yeah. And similarly, when we talk about, as we will in a few minutes, the enhanced unemployment insurance, we're talking about rent, really. We're talking about money that is going to go so that these people don't get kicked out of their apartments. Because this is not just a situation where people are temporarily unemployed. It's a really short period, but they'll probably find something within a couple of weeks. That is not necessarily the case, both because the jobs might not be there and it might not be safe to go back, which means that people will inevitably burn through their savings, which we know most Americans have very little of because they're so underpaid. This is going to subsidize rent. So if you're concerned for the landlords, then start talking about enhanced unemployment insurance, because that is where the vast majority of it is going to go and might need to go for potentially at least a year if the pandemic ends up being as bad as we think it will and if the vaccine doesn't roll out as fast as, you know, Trump dreams that it might. Debate is going on Capitol Hill right now about exactly what sort of benefit will go out to people as the pandemic continues to ravage communities across America. Will there be a one-time payment? Will there be a resumption of the $600 additional dollars of enhanced unemployment benefits? Well, not if it's up to Ted Cruz.
In terms of the unemployment benefits, do you object to providing any kind or any amount of federal boost to unemployment at this point? Because not everyone is choosing to be out of work.
The policy that Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are pushing adds an additional $600 a week of federal money to unemployment. We have the unemployment system.
And McConnell wants to take it down to 70% of prior wages.
The problem is, for 68% of people receiving it right now, they are being paid more on unemployment than they made in their job. And I'll tell you, I've spoken to small business owners all over the state of Texas who are trying to reopen, and they're calling their waiters and waitresses, they're calling their busboys, and they won't come back. And of course they won't come back, because the federal government is paying, in some instances, twice as much money to stay home.
But you're open to a lesser amount?
What we ought to focus on, instead of just shoveling trillions out the door.
Okay, so you'll notice there, when she asked him, well, what about like anything, a lesser amount? He's like, what we should focus on is me not answering that question, because I won't agree to five extra dollars a week. What did you think about that, about focusing on the business owners?
I mean, obviously, he does not care about small business owners at all. I mean, honestly, if Republicans need to take that word small business owner out of their mouths, because if they did, they would understand that the majority of loans and our assistance from all of the stimulus money has not been going to small businesses. In fact, the small businesses were unable to access the money they needed to stay open in the small window. And by that time, they already had to close down. So, like, if you're talking about small businesses, then help them directly. We're talking about workers. Mm-hmm. And the idea that workers are paid to stay home, good. That's the whole point. They don't want to come back to work. I wonder why. Maybe because there's a killer virus on the loose and they could die, and that people are dying who are going back to work. I mean, I'm sure everyone's reading these stories, but there's a heartbreaking story of a 35-year-old woman who infected both of her parents who were at risk. She was a grocery bagger in Texas, and now both of her parents are in the ICU. She wore masks. She wore bags. Nobody in the store obeyed that, or there wasn't a requirement to, and now both of her parents are on mm-hmm. death's door. So, like,
yeah,
that is in your state. And also, can we just talk about what is going on with Ted Cruz's facial hair?
Yeah, it needs to go.
He looks like a possum got in a fight with a raccoon, and that's all that's left. He's the possum. No. I don't want to see the wispy mm-hmm. mustache that just.
No, you're close. He is a possum cosplaying a Civil War general. That's what it is. Look, I agree with some of what you said, but I do have to take issue with one thing. Now, he rightfully calls out these damn waiters and busboys who are lazing about at home rather than jumping back into the trenches. And here's the thing. I was a waiter, and I was also a busboy and a dishwasher at an Italian restaurant. And we had a code, us busboys. It was something like neither rain nor sleet nor deadly pathogen. We're on the job, even if it kills us, especially if it kills us, actually, because we're getting paid
people need
less
their
than minimum
oysters.
Wage. Exactly. They need their pasta. And so if that means I have to die, gladly, gladly to bust those tables. No, it's ridiculous. I have an idea, Ted Cruz. Talk to less small business owners, which, as Francesca pointed out, you didn't even do that. Talk to a worker and find out why they don't want to go back. I have a suspicion. I think one reason they might not want to go back is because Texas just passed 5,000 deaths from coronavirus, which is a bad number, maybe scary, not quite as scary as this one. It had 1,000 in the last 6 days. Just Texas. Just 6 days. That's not even a week. They had 1,000 deaths. Maybe that is why these busboys and waiters and baristas aren't rushing back to earn minimum wage. Maybe. But what do I know? I just actually had those jobs.
No, and I think that once again, we have to, in a lot of ways, right, as we strive to be more anti-racist people, we should also strive, in my book, to be a little more anti-capitalist and to try to get the boss man out of our heads. And when you are told or you yourself are receiving more money than you would otherwise at a job, maybe you deserve it. We should be incentivizing people to stay home. Maybe your only job right now, a more important job, is for you to stay home and keep your family safe.
Yes.
That's the bottom line. Yeah. So don't feel bad about that money. That is what a country should do, is take care of its citizens and make it so that you don't feel like, oh gosh, I will be earning more money if I go back to work because it isn't safe.
Yeah. And if you're a right winger and that bothers you, that we would do this or that we'd focus on people not dying, then how about this? How about let's beat this pandemic so that period is as short as it can possibly be, rather than this ridiculous middling approach that we've done from the very beginning that means that people are dying and the economy is dying. That's been great so far. And by the way, as to why Ted Cruz would say what he said, I've thought about it, and I believe that he has a mission in life, and it is to never eat food that hasn't been spat in. I think that's what it is, and I think he's well on his way. Ted Cruz, don't eat in Texas. You know who was a waiter in Texas? This guy. You know who would have spat in your tikka masala? This guy. If I heard you say that about me while I was trying not to kill my family with a deadly virus.
That's nice that you think Ted Cruz would eat tikka masala. giving him way more credit.
It's a good restaurant. I'd find somebody I'd like. Ted Cruz aside, what is the government actually going to do when it comes to these enhanced unemployment benefits? Well, we have Steve Mnuchin, who is bothered by part of this process, as he makes clear in this video.
But the fundamental issue, and we all acknowledged, there was a technical problem where we were in an emergency last time, so we instituted this quickly, and in certain cases, people were paid more to stay home than they were to work. And I think that's something that the American public understands. We're not going to use taxpayer money to pay people more to stay home. So we're going to transition to a UI system that is based upon wage replacement. We've talked about approximately 70% wage replacement. And we're just going through the mechanics of that.
Okay, yeah, they're just going through the mechanics because that's all it is to him because he's incredibly wealthy and he has been his entire life because he was born into a wealthy family. The thing that has bothered me is that this bothers them more than anything since the pandemic began. It has burrowed into their brain that someone might be temporarily making slightly more than minimum wage, and they won't abide it. They can't abide it.
These people have never worked minimum wage in their lives. They don't know what that's like. They have no idea how to survive on $7 an hour plus tips or $4 or $5 an hour plus tips. Like, they've never worked these jobs ever. Steve Mnuchin, don't ever say his name without saying his middle name. His middle name is Steven Foreclosure King Mnuchin, okay?
Really?
This guy got rich off the 2008 financial collapse. He kicked people out of their homes. This man prides himself on the destitution of Americans. And don't ever look to the American people ever again before you look to your president, who has done F all to get this virus under control. Don't you ever come at Democrats. Don't you ever come at the American people. We are doing what little we can. It is completely, I'm like so incensed. I'm so mad. Mnuchin needs to disappear into his double chin forever. Goodbye.
Jesus. Yeah. Yeah. This is the only thing that is an injustice to them. From the beginning of the pandemic, through all of that, civil rights protests, all of that, this is the injustice, that they temporarily made a little bit more money and we're not going to abide by it. We're not going to, as he said, we're not going to spend taxpayer dollars to let people stay at home. And as many people in the chat have pointed out, those are taxpayers that are going to be subsidized during this pandemic. They're not, like, I know that you don't think of them as fully human, and they're certainly not like you, but they're taxpayers. Do you know, they paid taxes on all the money they made before they were unemployed. They pay taxes on their unemployment money. That extra $600, they pay taxes on that even. Like, they are literally taxpayers as you're giving them the money. But he's not going to give it to them.
What was the tax break for the wealth? Was it $1.9 trillion?
It was one. Yeah, well, it keeps getting revised upward as those tend to. But yeah, it was a couple of trillion dollars. And he worked himself up into a sort of Zuckerberg-esque fury over somebody temporarily making minimum wage once again while not having to work. How enraged do you remember him being when he was okaying literally trillions of dollars going to corporations as part of the stimulus during the pandemic? I don't remember a lot of anger at that point, even though it was a lot of money and could, in theory, have the companies end up making as much money as they were before the pandemic. For shame. Now, here's the other issue, though. Because what he just laid out there is, we've got a solution. We're going to pay them less. We're going to scale it down to like 70% or whatever. And then we're still going to pay them. We're not ghouls. We just look like that. Here's the issue with that. According to a memo from the National Association of State Workforce Agencies obtained by NPR over the weekend, they warned that replacing the flat weekly payment with a more complicated individualized benefit based on prior income, quote, would take 8 to 20 weeks or more for most states to fully implement, depending on the formula the White House and the GOP ultimately propose. The short end is 2 months, meaning that such implementation delay could mean a huge gap in payments and a bigger backlog for millions. And I would wager to guess that if you're the sort of person that desperately needs this extra $400 to $600, you can't wait 2 to 5 months to start getting it.
Steve Mnuchin's administration, I mean his department paid stimulus money to dead people. I want everyone to remember that when they're talking about implementing some other kind of complicated system. Dead people were paid. And I know a lot of folks didn't get the $1,200 stimulus check to begin with. A lot of people are still waiting for that. A lot of people are still waiting for unemployment. So you're absolutely right. Like, do we trust this government to deploy something minimally more complicated? No,
it's simple. Flat payment larger than $1,200 that recurs as long as the pandemic is going on, which might be the kick in the ass necessary for the government to actually do something about it. Enhance unemployment benefits for all who are laid off, and not through any fault of their own. They are being laid off, especially the ones that were laid off in the past couple of weeks, because of Republican governors and Donald Trump preemptively reopening the economy. That is not their fault. It wasn't their decision. They are a casualty of the economic war and public health war that the Republican Party is waging on the American people right now. And they need to be helped. And if it costs a lot, then fix it.
Exactly. If the shoe were on the other foot, can you imagine, guys, can you imagine for some reason, Democrats, the roles were reversed, right? And Democratic governors were the ones who were saying, go out and go to the beaches, gather, this virus is going away, nothing's happening. And Republican governors were the ones who were saying, who were exercising caution. They would be demanding every single minute of every single hour that blue states pay for their unemployment benefits, that blue states are the ones to blame. Well, the same thing, right? We should be blaming Republican governors. If we had a real opposition, we know that the reason this virus isn't under control, we know that the reason that we have to stay inside continually, that we have to refrain from working, refrain from gathering, is because these buckethead Republican governors did not exercise caution. So once again, how dare you, as an entire party, as a strategy? And honestly, the journalist's job in all of these situations truly is to point this out time and time and time again. All right? Exactly. We're not idiots. This has been how many? Only 4 months. We all remember what it was like back in March. We've been watching this every single day. We've been watching this train wreck in slow motion. You could have seen it a mile away.
Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of, like, the eviction crisis, of course, many people did. They just weren't really listened to. And so this only temporary measure was put into place. Like, yeah, it only needs to last till July because, well, come on, we're not going to have a pandemic after that. The Karens are out in force and they are so mad that they have to wear masks. And in some areas, these mask mandates are relatively new. And so they're coming up with interesting ways to protest that, leading to the birth of what I am calling the Swasta Karen. Take a look.
You're sick. Yeah, you're sick. You have an illness. You can't be American and wear that mask. You cannot. We literally had a war about this.
I kill not. My grandfather.
You're wearing a swastika.
If you vote for Biden, you're gonna be in Nazi Germany. That's what it's gonna be like.
You're sick.
You're literally wearing a Nazi flag right now.
Yeah, because that's what's going to happen here in America.
You're sick.
Okay, there was no way that we weren't going to play this with Francesca on the show. What do you think?
What a fail. It's just like, it's the Nazi fail, you know? I love the Nazi fail because, of course, you know, the cult of Trumpism. Everything else is Nazism except for their leader, the one sending federal troops into, you know, cities and around the country. But she's trying to explain herself. You hear her. She's like, no, it's not that I believe in Nazism. It's that the mask is fascist, and this is what's going to happen if we keep having to wear masks. Don't you get that? Don't you get that from me wearing a swastika on my mouth? Like, no, lady, we don't get it. You failed miserably, you guys. And if you have to explain it, it doesn't work. You just look like Nazis, which is brilliant because that's what the cult of Trumpism is.
You know what it gave me strong vibes of as you were saying that? when you think about her, like, you know what? I'm going to show them what they're going to have. And then they're like, you have a swastika. And she's like, but no, this is what you're going to have. It's like, if you recall that old Seinfeld, when Kramer was protesting the post office by saying that the bucket was on the head of the postman, that's how they blinded you with the mail. And everyone was like, but then shouldn't the bucket be on your head? It's like, they just don't get what they're trying to say. Why is it on the postman if the mail has blinded us? Anyway, but yeah, isn't it weird? This isn't the first time, by the way, that one of these anti-mask people has been like, oh no, I only have a swastika because you guys are Nazis. At the original anti-lockdown protest, they had like swastika signs they were holding and saying, that's because the governor's a Nazi. That's why I made this giant swastika that I've been longing to scrawl on cardboard for as long as I can remember. And that's why I'm holding it jubilantly in the air. It's because you're a Nazi, not me. I'm just the one holding the swastika in 2020.
Mm-hmm. My president just inspires actual Nazis to take the street. But no, that's not what this is. Just write a few more words, guys. I know you've got the words. Just write, you are the swastika. Exactly. This is swastika. Like, yeah. Whatever you need to do, just pad it with something, because then you have to avoid. But can I just say that was just the way that their masks look? They were very like, they look like very Dr. Seuss Hop on Pop twins, like with their little swastikas. Like.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, to that point, we had a question a little bit ago from a viewer is like, can you be in a relationship where there are these big political differences? This is the opposite. It shows the value of finding someone with your very specific set of beliefs. How beautiful. Find you a person who will like wrap a Nazi flag around their head.
Yes.
Yeah. No, mm-hmm. Don't do that, though. That's a bad idea. But wow. Yeah, they were banned for a year from that Walmart. They can't go back there. Of course, the thing is, I guess no one's seen their face. So how are you going to stop them? Although maybe they wear the masks a lot, the swastika flag. Anyway, yeah, all this
was
is because.
Remember in San Diego, there was a dude who was just straight up shopping with a KKK hood on?
Yeah.
He's like, no, this is because this is like the KKK.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we just got a comment from Man with 2 Feet who asked a great question. I believe I asked it of the guy in San Diego. Man with 2 Feet says, if they're not Nazis, why did they already have the masks? That's a pretty good point. Like, if I want to make a point about how you're being a Nazi, I don't have a swastika to do that with, because no normal person has a swastika printed out. But they did. Where did they get
it? Oh, it was very homemade, John. They bonded over it. You think? And that's the thing, is like, they had a lot of time to think through whether this was going to effectively communicate their message that wearing masks was like, Hitler's Third Reich.
Yeah.
And they shoddily sewed that together, because let's be real, pretty shoddy job, not a great mask. Mm-hmm. And they decided after that 5 hours it took for them to sew it, yes, that was a good idea still.
Yeah.
And that one didn't need a little sign that was like, okay, my mask is going to say this is like, and your mask is going to be the swastika. But maybe they argued about who was going to wear the swastika or not.
And like, neither would budge.
Yeah, so they both decided. Exactly.
No, it's just like, I look better on the right. Steven says, find your soul hate. Exactly. And by the way, Rafaela Mueller is the individual who took the video. Thank you to Rafaela for doing that, so we can see that they literally did that. It's not just like, it looks kind of like a swastika. It really was one. Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota instituted a mandate requiring face coverings in indoor public spaces and businesses in an attempt to curb the spread of COVID-19, which makes sense to you if you accept that there's a pandemic, but a significant percentage of this country does not. I have been very critical of the government response to the pandemic and to the civil rights protests of the past few months, maybe too much so, because while Donald Trump still isn't doing much, Melania is trying to fix things by announcing that she's going to be revamping the White House Rose Garden. She's renovating it, a signature showcase of power used by presidents for decades. And asked about this, she said, our country has seen difficult times before, but the White House and the Rose Garden have always stood as a symbol of our strength, resilience, and continuity. Not continuity with reality, I'm detached from that, but continuity with Rose Gardens of the past. Yeah, they're going to be doing an upgrade. It's going to include electrical upgrades for television appearances, a new walkway, new flowers and shrubs, two new colors of roses. It's meant to be an act of expressing hope and optimism for the future, which we all need because we've got a government that is doing literally nothing to help us other than plant roses. So all we have is hope for the future.
Look, Melania is trapped in a loveless relationship that she absolutely deserves every minute of. And that's whatever. And you look, her Be Best campaign didn't quite take off the way it needed to, maybe because no one could understand what it was about. But this I support, but only if she frames it in this, like, hashtag quarantine projects, like stay at home with Melania. Everyone's redoing their gardens. Everyone's working, you know, hey, from a small succulent houseplant to your giant rose garden. Like that I would excuse. This just feels a little bit like, you know, the Queen of Hearts is painting the roses red.
There are Queen of Hearts vibes. It's like very a little bit Wonderland, a little bit Versailles mixed together. Yeah. Yeah. If it was like, hey, this week we're planting roses in the rose garden, next week sourdough, then yes, maybe as sort of like, because she's so detached from everything, that would be good. But that's not what we're getting. What we're getting is, at the same time that White House officials, like we showed you, are arguing that people haven't earned the $600 of unemployment insurance, we're going to spend what I only imagine is more than a couple hundred bucks revamping a rose garden that Donald Trump mostly uses to attack Biden during press conferences. That seems a little bit detached from the struggles that working class Americans are currently experiencing.
I hope there are handrails on the walkway because, you know, that Trump needs it. Yeah, slippery. I think there will be fountains of blood as well.
Exactly.
Not complete without the fountains of blood.
Paint the roses with the blood of the young. Mm-hmm. I don't believe the Q stuff. Don't come for me. But anyway,
there will be Botox stations. It'll be beautiful. I don't know what accent I'm doing. I forgot how to do Melania.
You've done Melania on your show.
I have. And I've deliberately, I took a lot of heat. This was in the first year of Trump's presidency when everyone was like, maybe we misunderstood America. Maybe, oh my God, reach across the aisle, our bubbles. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad we're done with that phase. Yeah. Of ridiculousness, but I was making fun of Melania, not really directly. It was like a makeup tutorial, and people got so mad. How dare you make fun of Melania? How dare you, you know, imitate her? Once again, we live in a country that has free speech, and I'm glad we're over the honeymoon period with this fascist.
Yes, and let's just recall she was a birther, and she's awful, and she's done literally nothing apparent to stop Donald Trump from being his worst self. So we get to criticize her because she's in a position of authority and influence, and she's using it to plant roses rather than to protect kids from being thrown into cages or get Donald Trump to wear a mask and stop 1,000 people a day from dying from a pandemic that we could have prevented. Yeah.
It's going to be very ugly. It's going to be bad.
You mean the rest of the election?
No, the Rose Garden.
Oh, yeah. Well, you remember her Christmas thing with the red trees that looked like they had been bathed in blood. Yeah. Yeah.
It's going to be just like jagged rocks. Again, fountains of blood in addition to the Botox station, just cold steel.
It's the like, Mordor garden.
Very much so.
I know that throughout this pandemic, a lot of people have been missing professional sports and have been wondering, when are we going to get back to it? Well, for some sports, they have already resumed, generally with like digital audiences and things like that. But there are fears that this entire thing could fall apart thanks to COVID-19, and it has not taken long for that to be demonstrated, with the Miami Marlins home opener set for Monday night against the Baltimore Orioles being canceled due to a COVID-19 breakout, with at least 14 people, including players and coaches, testing positive in recent days, sources told ESPN. The MLB says it's going to be conducting more testing, and they put out a statement saying that the members of the Marlins traveling party are self-quarantining in place while awaiting the outcome of those results. Now, obviously, you know, wish the best to those players and the coaches and their families. Hope that it hasn't spread beyond that and that they get past it quickly. This does demonstrate the fear that even with no crowds and even with them being relatively walled off, it is still a pandemic and pandemic spread, and it already has.
I mean, that's a forfeiture to me. Orioles win, dude. This is...
You're a monster. You're a monster.
Come on. I mean, look, I do, once again, retribution to the red states. Mm-hmm. Miami Marlins, Florida, DeSantis, you reap what you sow. It's right there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't individually reap what they sow because so far as I know, the Miami Marlins players weren't advocating for no masks. But
of course not.
This is a natural consequence of DeSantis and Trump's strategy.
I'm just saying, like, these governors don't deserve... I'm like, look, I know people need some kind of respite and that sports are a lot of people's respite and we can't all, you know, make cocktails like Franny, Mama Fran over here. but I don't know if we need another distraction. We have 100 days to the election. Our cases are on the rise. Maybe we should focus elsewhere.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure that's an unpopular opinion. I know a lot of comedians and podcasters who are like, please, sports need to come back so I have something to talk about.
Yeah.
But we've got bigger fish to fry. A bigger marlin to fry.
I don't know if you fry. Alyssa Young says, John is so soft, everyone is a monster. Thanks. Yeah, and look, I want things to be back. I mean, I don't care if sports come back. I mean, for other people's sake, I'm not going to watch them or whatever. I got a million things I got to do. But you know what? I'd love for Black Widow to be released. There's a new James Bond movie, which I should have already watched like 10 times, but can't because of this pandemic. I've got a stake in the game too, everybody. It just doesn't, it's not round and you don't chuck it. But I do care. And just think about, like, for the right-wingers who are so obsessed with this as a symbol. Like, Sean Hannity from the very beginning has been saying, we gotta have sports, we gotta have sports. Think about how powerful it would be. I'm saying this at the risk of giving Trump the election. If he actually locked everything down for, like, 2 solid months, maybe a little bit longer, 2 solid months, mask mandates with penalties if you don't do it, actual assistance to everyone who's going to be harmed by this so that we minimize the economic damage, you actually bend the curve down to almost zero as many other countries, including countries that were very hard hit, like Italy, have been able to do, and then he cruises the last month to the election, having beaten the pandemic, and businesses are reopening, this big, giant, baby idiot doesn't get that that is the only winning strategy available to him.
For
and he
sure.
is too proud or too stupid to actually follow it.
Amen. That is exactly right.
Thank you. Well, Francesca, you've been the best as always. Thank you so much for joining us. We always look forward to Mondays for having you here.
I do too, John.
And Sundays as well. Why is that?
Oh, thanks for asking. I have a podcast. It's called The Bituation Room. Every Sunday live, 6-9 Eastern. Mm-hmm. My YouTube is at Franny Fio, so you can watch it there or you can listen as a podcast later. I realize I'm doing Trump hands and I apologize.
And I got a notification, I think it was a little bit earlier, that the most recent episode had been uploaded to my Pocket Cast, and the title is Cuomo is Not Your Boyfriend. So how is that not going to be fun? Come on.
Yes, we talk all about Medicare for All. There was another title in the running that was very much not safe for the damage report, and you'll have to listen to the episode to find out what that title was. But yeah, we talked about Medicare on a statewide level. It was really good.
I buy that because the name of your show is barely okay for the damage report. Yeah. So the titles go even crazier. Okay, Francesca, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you, John. Be well.
You too. Be safe out there. Very excited to welcome back to the program, senior reporter for The Root and the host and founder of the Black Diplomats podcast, Terrell Starr. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hey, thank you. I'm happy to be here. Y'all are my favorite guys. So.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to have you here. And you're here via Ukraine, actually. That's where you're located right now.
Yes, I'm in the Western Carpathian Mountains. A night train over from Kiev, the capital, further in the east or central part of the area. Yeah, in the cabin, as a matter of fact.
Well, you might well be our first guest who's Skyping in from Ukraine, probably a gap that we should have filled a while ago. But we want to talk about a number of different things. Obviously, Ukraine's going to be a part of it. But let's start off with the podcast, the Black Diplomats podcast. What was the sort of the mission behind it?
So Black Diplomats podcast is really about bringing in non-white voices to have conversations about foreign policy, but also decolonizing the conversation when it comes to foreign affairs. And so we look at the foreign affairs model one from an imperial complex, right? One that puts America at the top and everyone else at the bottom, or the bottom people looking to America as a moral foundation. But as you all know, with the Young Turks and the work that you all do, you know America is full of shit. And so what I do from a foreign policy perspective is explain why America is full of shit. And so a lot of publications that aim at publications or podcasts that talk about foreign policy, they center American thinking, they center Western ideals, but they center, again, an imperialist construct, right? One that sent one, and a capitalist construct when you think about the military industrial complex. My challenge with Black diplomats is to say that Black people are disproportionately harmed by all these complexes, not only Black people, but other people of color. And ultimately, when we really think about it, white people are being screwed over by this military-industrial complex. We just need a platform where we're bold enough to say so. And so Black diplomats, for going on our sixth episode, is really about bringing all these voices together, centering Black people, centering people of color, so that we can really create a safe space, a space where you don't feel like you have to fit this conventional definition of an expert in order to talk about the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And to the, I mean, look, the U.S. media has been long criticized, and rightfully so, for not having much coverage of what goes on outside of our borders. But even when they do, it tends to be academics, overwhelmingly white, very rarely people who are actually affected by the events or the policies that they're talking about. But and you're not just talking to people who can analyze it. You're talking to people who are affected by what America does domestically and abroad.
Absolutely. And that's the whole point. So the reason why I named my podcast Black Diplomat is that anybody can be a diplomat. You don't have to be in the Foreign Service. You don't have to be a part of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs if we're talking about Europe or any other part of the world. You just have to be somebody that is curious about where you live and having a conversation with somebody across borders. That's what being a diplomat is. Picking up the torch, being willing to say that this is what's going on in my community. Tell me about what's going on in your community so we can have conversations. And what often happens, and I've learned this from my job as a senior reporter at The Root, traveling around the country, you really don't get an understanding about how people look at America until you get on a plane, you go down to Mississippi, you go down to the Delta, you go down to Middle America, you go to Detroit, you go to Baltimore, you leave this social media network where you have kind of like all the intellectual thought, which is important, right? I mean, that adds value. That leads to discourse in many respects. But if you want to understand the electorate, it's about getting your feet on the ground and talking to the people. And that's what Black diplomats does. But the only difference is that we're doing it on a global scale. And so we're getting the feet of the people are on the podcast. And so I purposefully center people who are activists who are doing the work. One of my episodes, the second episode, dealt with a Black woman, an Ethiopian woman who organizes domestic workers in Lebanon, because a lot of Ethiopians go to Lebanon for domestic work. And in Lebanon, they have something like a modern day slavery system for people who go there. And so Lebanon is going through a currency crisis. And so where do we hear about these stories where somebody can go on for an hour and talk about these things? And so Black diplomats is that destination. And so absolutely, it's all about the people. And as we proceed, we're going to have more conversations with the people. One of our episodes is going to deal with LGBTQ plus people in Eastern Europe. What is it like to be an activist? What is it like to do the work, be on the ground, and advocate for your rights if you're a gay person or if you're a trans person in Russia, in Georgia? And so that's the thing about Russia. When you hear about Russia, we're going to hear about queer voices, gay voices, the unconventional voices that that we rarely hear about, as opposed to the people at the think tanks.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. And I'm already looking forward to, hopefully us talking again in the future and talking about more of your episodes, because, I can't. The two examples you just cited, I mean, maybe at some point something was talked about on CNN, but I can't remember. And if it was, it was probably someone in the U.S. who had traveled there rather than someone on the ground who's actually working on it. You know, you did mention, though, getting that perspective of America and its policies from people who aren't inherently biased by living here. And so you're in Ukraine right now. And I'm curious, I've been wondering, as 2020 has developed and America has failed to address the pandemic worse than perhaps any country in the world, and its reaction to the civil rights protests have been incredibly barbaric and cruel. How are people outside of the U.S. seeing that?
That's an excellent question. So a lot of people now, the wool has been removed from people's eyes in many respects. People see America for what it truly is. And in my personal experience, I'm unique in that I am a Black American that a lot of Ukrainians don't really have any access to or exposure to. In fact, my guest here, my host, who's hosting me at this property, I'm the first American that she's dealt with. And so American, period, right? Now, mind you, I'm in the mountains of Western Ukraine. And so, you know, there's a lot of curiosity about Trump. There's a lot of curiosity about protests and everything. And so I think that people, there's really a question about, wow, I thought America was a civil society. I thought America, these types of things don't happen. And so I think a lot of us live under the assumption that people think that they know, that people think that folks know what's going on in America. But in reality, they really have very little idea. They see things in the media, but they don't know who to trust or what to trust or which resources are telling them the truth, because they've been bought into this idea of American exceptionalism, right? Even though in their hearts, they know it's not true. One thing that complicates that is that the Americans that they do have contact with are often white, and they don't have the personal experiences, unless they're vigilant about it, to tell them that the America that they've grown up to understand is not what it is. And so I spend a great deal of my time in my own kind of personal diplomacy, giving them the real, much more clear story about all of the troubles and all of the racism and all the white supremacy and the imperialism that America undertakes in order to assume its power. And those conversations often are very illuminating for people here.
Yeah. You know, you say that they're not sure what news they should trust. Mm-hmm. And like when I'm combing through the news every day to put together my show, I don't always know necessarily. And I live here. So I can only imagine how much more difficult it is when you're stripped of the context of growing up around some of these outlets.
Yeah, but listen, though, when you think about news and information, my job and your job is to disseminate information. We're trained to do this. OK, so we're media junkies. We're on social media. We know the responsibility of looking at a story, giving you the facts as they are. And we know if there's something that's bogus or something that's questionable. We know how to do that. Most people are not trained in media literacy. And one of the reasons why is that, if you really think about it, I don't know how old you are. I'm 40 years old. And so I remember the times back in the early 2000s where you only had the outlets of the major three, the CBS, ABC, you know, CNN, you name it, you know, NBC, right? You know, those outlets. And, you know, you had the advent of Fox News eventually that came on later. But you had these four or five entities that, you know, from a broadcast standpoint, then you had the New York Times and the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, et cetera. They had something like a monopoly on news dissemination. And so you had these few outlets where you could see, okay, if news got out, it likely came from these places. Now you have social media where somebody could come on and they themselves can become a source of news. I know, even as an independent journalist, I function that way. You function that way. However, we both are trained as journalists, right? And so it's not, but just imagine the people, you know, there are so many people online who have a personality and have a cult of personality. And because of that alone, they're considered news sources, okay? Yeah. You know, and so and the thing is that the way that our Constitution works, being able to disseminate news is not dependent on where you work. It's a freedom of speech. And if people believe your speech, you can build a platform off of it. That's what people don't understand about the dissemination of information. Unlike doctors, unlike lawyers, unlike other professions, there's no license to be a journalist. It's about where you work.
you right now, you're newly in Ukraine. Tell me a little bit about what you've gone to Ukraine for, what you're hoping to investigate. I'm sure it's going to inform your podcast and probably your work with The Root as well.
Yes. Yeah. So there are a couple things. One, I'm technically on a book leave. I'm here technically writing a book, and it's my memoir about traveling to living in Ukraine, Georgia, the country of Georgia and Russia as a Black man, and how growing up in a Black city like Detroit and then coming over here, how both those experiences merged together and informed the way that I look at even U.S. Politics and domestic policy. My upbringing growing up in Detroit and coming over here as a Black man informs how I view the way that U.S. politics functions, right? So that's the primary thing. But in regards to the other stories I'm working on, I'm here basically to part of being an expert in this part of the world requires you to actually be here, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times I come here just to see what's going on. So this particular trip, I focus on tourism development. I focus on how the country is responding to COVID-19, because ultimately it's not just about the politics and the parliament and everything. It's really about, if someone calls me on to talk about Burisma, or call me that on to talk about Joe Biden's dealings here in Ukraine, part of it is just being able to tell you, I've traveled to this town, I've traveled to that town, I've been hanging out with these amount of friends, I've been hanging out with these amount of friends, and nobody fucking talks about Burisma. And that's actually the truth. Like, no one does it. And so this is just something that Trump and the Republicans are concocting, because no one talks about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
You know,
you have to be in these kind of fancy circles in order to get it. I mean, like, going about your day, you're not going to go to some tea, you know, some cafe and overhear people, oh, Joe Biden, the election. No one cares, okay? Mm-hmm. But because I'm here, I could kind of, like, tell you that. But on another level, it's really about when I go here, and also, you know, eventually Russia, which is the next destination I have to go to. You know, part of this is, I think that the American public, we've spent 2016, for example, talking about Russia, 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 Russia. But if you tell them you can't talk about the Kremlin, you can't say Putin, you can't say Siberia, you can't say cold, you know, you just give them a number of things and say, okay, you can't mention any of these things. What do you know about Russia? Come to find out, people can't tell you jack about Russia, all right? So it's a lesson for us, right, and about what people prioritize and what people ought to know. And so me being here is about being in touch with the people, because my job as a podcaster is to connect people to people. And so over the next few weeks, you will be hearing me talk directly to the people about what they're thinking, what their thoughts are about their country, about their future. And I think that'll help us as journalists, but also the work that I'll do, I hope, will instruct the general population on how to engage local people here. And often it's not through the types of things that we are hearing about through the major networks in DC and New York.
Yeah. No, so much of what you just said is really fascinating, because, like, I like to think that I have at least a somewhat broad horizon. I try to cover international news. It's obviously, it's been a little bit more rare during the pandemic. I've been very focused on that. It's a failing of mine. But when you said that you were in Ukraine, instantly, first thing in my mind is, yeah, that was a pretty big story. Biden and Trump and Ukraine and what they were going to do. And you said no one's there talking about it. Funnily enough, nobody's really talking about it here either, despite the fact that it seemed like it was going to be this big thing.
Well, here's the thing, right? Like, it's proven here that we could talk about Hunter Biden. Like, we could talk about the idea that, was it a good look for him to be on this board making X amount of dollars while his dad was vice president? We can have a conversation about how families of elected officials like a vice president should be engaged in these type of dealings. That's a separate conversation than saying that Joe Biden was engaged in a corrupt and corrupt behavior, right? That's completely different. It's also false. Okay, we can say whatever we want about Joe Biden, but Joe Biden did not engage in any type of nefarious dealings while he was here. It just didn't happen. And another thing is that being here and studying this region and understanding the players, the people that Rudy Giuliani is pulling out are at the bottom of the barrel. No one here respects them. Okay, but here's the thing: as somebody who doesn't understand Ukrainian politics, the app, which is most American viewers, they don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
you know, it's funny you say that though. I don't know much about Ukrainian politics, but when Rudy Giuliani raised these people up, I suspected nobody respected them. I wasn't sure, but I suspected.
But most people don't. Yeah, but see, the thing is, because you are trained to funnel out bullshit,
mm-hmm.
you are able to deduce that without knowing anything about it because you're trained and what you're trained to ask questions and be curious. But yeah. most Americans, most people are not trained in media literacy.
Yeah. I want to ask you one more question, just because I'm now curious about Ukraine. You mentioned there that that's one of the things that people are worried about is coronavirus. Tell me about the experience there. How is it affecting people's lives? Has it become politicized the way that it has in America? Do they have faith in their government to deal with it? And I know, you know, when Trump talks about Europe, how it looks like they have less cases, that's just because they do less testing. Is that the impression that you get? What's the reality on the ground in Ukraine for the fight against the coronavirus?
Well, the reality in Ukraine is that they're dealing with far fewer resources than the United States. And here, the country is still very much a challenge. When I came to Ukraine, I have to have travel insurance that if something happens to me, if something requires an emergency evacuation, I needed a document or proof of insurance that would ensure that I would be able to get myself out of the country so I would not burden or tax the healthcare infrastructure of this country. So I had to have that. Right now, Ukraine is not part of the European Union. So while most countries in the European Union have banned Americans from coming, Ukraine welcomes Americans. We just have to go under this quarantine for 14 days. So I have an app on my phone where I have to take a photo of myself each day, and the app scans the metadata so I can pinpoint where I am. And yeah, so it's surveillance. Okay, let's just call it what it is, surveillance, right? And so
yeah, it seems like it.
Yeah, it's surveillance. And so that's their way of keeping track of foreigners that are coming in. And so why is Ukraine doing that? I'm actually going to be doing doing some reporting on this in the next few weeks, but what you surmise is that Ukraine, it can't afford to drastically cut off its tourism industry, mm-hmm. right? So that's what you're suffering with. And in a doctor here, they're making $500, $600 a month. If that nurses are making $300, $400 or roughly lower. So you're dealing with a system that's not only taxed, but people are underpaid. And so it's a lot more stressed than America. But in regards to the faith in government, the current president, Zelensky, is in a pretty precarious situation. You know, he came in this idea of I'm going to reform the country. And he came in under this idea. He beat a former president Petro Poroshenko, right? And a lot of it was that it was because of the failure to end the war that's going on in the eastern part of the country, that's in Donetsk and Luhansk, and the annexation of Crimea. And so Zelensky, who was a professional comedian, entertainer, came in and spoke about it and spoke a better game. Now, obviously, governance is a lot different and a lot more challenging than campaigning. And so he's having a rough going, and, you know, he's had a lot of mixed reviews, and people's faith in him has declined over the past months. And so Zelensky is dealing with the war. He's dealing with the war in eastern Ukraine. He's dealing with the annexation of a country where basically a third of the country is in Russian control, and he's dealing with a pandemic. So when we say he's having a rough go of it, that's a severe understatement. And so there are a lot of people who feel as though he is not making strong enough decisions to fight corruption. A lot of the reformers that were in that were part of the administration are no longer part of the administration because they've been sacked. So if you're asking for my analysis, he's not doing well. Okay. he's not doing well. And this pandemic is only making it worse.
Okay. Well, look, it's obviously a very different country from the U.S., but a lot of the troubles sound pretty similar to what we're experiencing right now. So, yeah. And it sounds like there is a ton for you to dig into in Ukraine. But also, when you get to Russia, I would be fascinated to learn a little bit more about what's going on the ground. So we should definitely touch base further into your travels. Where can people see more of your work as your travels continue?
Oh, thank you very much. So go to my Instagram. My Instagram is my government name, Terrell J Star, on Instagram, at Terrell, T-E-R-R-E-L-L, J Star. Now, I have a Twitter account, Russia_Star. I'm actually, because I'm on my book leave, I'm avoiding it. But so you can come to my Instagram. And also, finally, Black Diplomats. Go to blackdiplomats.net. where you find the website, but also go to any podcast app and you can download Black Diplomats. We drop an episode every single week. This week, just giving you a preview. I normally don't tell people who I'm going to be interviewing next, but this Saturday, we're dropping an interview with Beatrice Finn, who is the 2017 Nobel Prize winner for her efforts to abolish nuclear weapons.
Wow. No, that sounds awesome. Terrell, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And best of luck in your work in Ukraine and beyond.
Hey, thank you. Anytime.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.